Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast,
showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change.
Welcome to another episode of the IB Green Minds podcast. I am delighted to present our guest this week, Cornelia Gomez, the head of ESG and sustainability at PAI Partners. So firstly, thank you, Cornelia, for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me, Nicholas.
So just quickly, for the listeners who may not know, PAI Partners is one of Europe's oldest private equity investors and a leader in integrating ESG analysis in their investment process. So could you maybe provide some insight from the private equity space? What do you see as being the main value of ESG integration?
Yes, certainly. So private equity is definitely not the biggest asset class out there in the finance world, but it's probably the one that has the most leverage in relations with ESG. So if you look at the activity of a private equity firm and you add maybe two caveats, that would be you're a majority shareholder of a company, and which means you're going to have a majority share, but also you're going to have decision power, the board, and you will probably be choosing the management team. You'll be incentivizing the management team. And basically, on a more pragmatic standpoint, you'll probably be on the phone. The investment team will probably be on the phone with the CEO once a week. So that's one thing. So you're a majority shareholder, and you have a longer term, a longer horizon than a trader, and you're closer to the asset than a debt lender or somebody who, you know, dabbles in obligations and stocks. Mm-hmm. So you're sitting in a unique position to influence the company, but also in a way, the valuation of this company is going to be, you're going to be impacted by the ESG risks that the company is taking and by the ESG opportunities that they're seizing.
So would you say that is the main driver for PAI to incorporate ESG in the investment decision? Is the valuation at the end of the day?
To be honest, so private equity is a little late compared to the corporate world. So when corporate companies were working on their supply chains, signing up to the Global Compact, hiring CSR teams already back in 2000, and they were legally expected to have CSR reports, at least in France in 2012, the private equity landscape is a little bit of a laggard. So typically the Global Compact of the private equity, which is the UNPRI, has, you know, has kind of spruced in terms of number of signatories between 2010 and 2015. So at the time, the driver was definitely our investors, so that we call our LPs, so limited partners. Our limited partners were expecting us to have a position, say something, build monitoring approaches and processes. What I've witnessed in the last, I would say, 3 to 4 years is a shift from, you know, tell me approach to show me approach from LPs, but also inwardly within the private equity firms, the willingness to look at ESG topics as value creation drivers rather than just risk and compliance tick box approach. And it's becoming very significant in the last year because we are, or at least the ESG teams, but also the stakeholders in the ecosystem around private equity are building business cases around the bottom line. So it's a triple bottom line approach, you know. So right. if you work on energy efficiency, if you reduce absenteeism, if you work on employee retention, you're going to be improving your bottom line, and also you're going to improve online reputation, consumer perception. So even though it's very hard to measure, the end game is that you will be exiting a company that has higher value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I was wondering if you could maybe provide a quick insight and maybe an example of how you use ESG when you are making that investment decision.
Yeah, so you have to look at this every asset class has its own investment life cycle. And even within private equity, you have a lot of differences. depending on your size, whether your infrastructure is small, major, or large cap. But in general, you'll be looking at an asset in an origination committee. Then you'll be getting serious about it. And the investment team will be extending a non-binding offer. And you have this phase that opens up, the due diligence phase that opens up, that can be more or less long, where you can have more or less access to information, more or less access to the management team. And it also depends on the country you're in. But the way we see our role, and it's generally expected, is that you will be running, you will be looking at all the blind spots, and you'll be playing the devil's advocate on this deal, trying to understand what are the non-financial risks that the investment team hasn't seen, or the ESG risk that down the line will be in financially impacting the company. So typically, if you're looking at a healthcare deal where there is the core of the business is around patient data, you will want to focus on GDPR. Because if the company's going to be hacked and you haven't run pen tests and you're about to lose patient data or have patient data compromised in the next 2-3 years, not only are you going to pay a huge penalty under GDPR regulation, but also it's going to impact your license to operate. If you were looking at a consumer facing company, we'll be looking at packaging, product safety, life cycle analysis. But I think it's important to say that the minimum a PE company should do is take all reasonable steps and ask as much questions as possible. But I think we have to be mindful that it is a pre-ownership phase. So generally, you won't have time to look at the opportunities, rather at the risks, I'd say.
So in an initial stage, it's more looking at using ESG essentially as another angle to look at potential risks which would otherwise be ignored by a traditional financial narrative.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, that's true. It is a very accurate description of what we do today and what we did, I would say, up to quite recently. But the future of that activity, so ESG diligence, in my view, is that it needs to be taken back by the investment teams. Our goal, at least, is to build ownership for the investment teams. Down the line, they should be running those analysis, and ESG teams should really just act as, you know, referee on what are the most important topics they should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. I think one topic which has come up recently, and which I'm quite interested in specifically around the E in ESG, is biodiversity loss. Mm. And in France, there's been quite a lot of legislative activity in that space. I was wondering if you could maybe provide a bit of an insight as to how you take that into account. And it's a very hard space to do that.
Absolutely. So it's very interesting. Biodiversity is such a complex topic. I think the key message here is it's incredibly hard to quantify. Right. And it is incredibly hard to quantify because biological diversity means a variability among living organisms from all sources, including, you know, terrestrial, marine, aquatic ecosystem. The definition in itself is complex and shows that we're talking about moving parts. So it will probably be extremely hard to look at this in the due diligence phase, but we're trying to engage our portfolio companies. So I was mentioning this investment life cycle. We have quite a lot of time in the ownership period to be looking at different topics. And quite interestingly, currently one of our most advanced portfolio companies in terms of CSR has decided and is taking kind of a bold step and has decided, and it's a B Corp company already. So then they're wondering, so what now we're B Corp, what can we do? What's left to do? And they've decided to tackle the topic of biodiversity. So we've been carrying some research and talking to service providers now for a few weeks. And what we found out is that today there are no standards for to measure the impact on biodiversity. You can look at ecosystems, you can look at species, you can look at genomas, and it's like a pyramid. And for each part of the pyramid, you will have different ways of calculating the impact on the biodiversity. You also, one thing that is also difficult is that for carbon footprint, climate change, we have the GIEC and the recommendation of the TCFD that thankfully is becoming a standard and a framework that everybody's progressively adapting to, whatever initiative you belong to, whatever asset class or sector you belong in. It's not the same for biodiversity. You do have a GIEC for biodiversity, but you had a convention on biological diversity at COP15, mm-hmm. but since then, it's a bit of a lonely child right now in terms of topic. But what we, for example, just to give you an idea, big companies who have taken very strong SBT commitments, like Danone, for example, will not have defined clear trajectories on biodiversity. So what can we, so how, what do we intend to do about this? Well, I think we're going to, the best way forward is to link the topic of biodiversity to a life cycle approach.
Okay.
And really bring it back to the topic, to how the company produces, what does it produce, where does it produce from, and at each step of the life cycle, look at the water footprint, look at the ecosystem quality, look at the use of natural resources.
Right, as you can probably tell, it's an area which I'm personally very interested in, which is why I asked you. I agree, it's incredibly challenging. Would you think it would take some sort of global target, the way the world has agreed on 2 degrees for climate change? Do you think some sort of equivalent would be the necessary next step to really take biodiversity more into like a mainstream?
Yes, I think, so you have different actors who are pushing in this field. NGOs are really, I think, learning from past, I would never use the word mistakes, but are learning from past experiences and are collaborating in a very efficient manner with businesses. Because you want to avoid hyper complexity. So, everybody can adopt the SDGs and have a very unpopular opinion on the SDGs, or politically incorrect opinion about the SDGs for P and for companies, because I struggle to see this in another way than a very good governmental roadmap. But typically, if you're going to look at the SDGs that relate to biodiversity, it really is no help to companies that are actually trying to understand where they're taking the natural resources from. Mm-hmm. How is that impacting? How will that be impacted in terms of hydric stress? What should they do differently? And really defining a unit of measure. The good news is we're seeing, so NGOs picking up, there are also some interesting initiatives around life cycle impact assessment. So you've probably heard about Impact World Plus, which is a globally rich method for life cycle impact assessment, so LCIA. We're discussing with different advisors on what is the right unit. So you have, tons of CO2 equivalent. What would be the right unit to measure the impact on ecosystem quality? And we are definitely, I mean, at least on our side, we're definitely trying to build a response. Something that's very interesting is that we've seen during the COVID, this comic strip where you see this city or this man with one wave coming to him, written COVID-19 on it. And then you have another one that says recession. And then you have another one that says climate change. And actually, I think you can add another huge wave behind it. That's the biodiversity collapse.
Right.
And that's why if anybody has a great idea, or can recommend initiatives on that theme, we're all ears.
Great. I'm thinking of doing my thesis on it, so I'll let you know.
Brilliant.
You mentioned life cycle analysis and the life cycle approach. I think that ties quite nicely with another topic I was interested in discussion, which was supply chain risk. I think that's something which has come up a lot around the COVID pandemic as well. I was wondering, you know, how do you account for that in your investment? Yeah.
So this is actually supply chain sustainability is really a topic close to my heart, because actually that was my previous life in the corporate world. I visited and spent a lot of time in factories as a social compliance manager for a retail group. So I can tell you how, you know, drums of your dishwashers are made, and the water boilers and bras, t-shirts, and it's very interesting to set out to understand how things are made, to quote this very good documentary that is actually now available on YouTube. And I think unfortunately very few people today, and I'm talking, you know, generally about consumers, really truly care to know how things are made. They want to know who made it. They are increasingly conscious about the impact of how it was made and how it was packaged and where it was made. But very few people have endeavored to get a complete traceability on what they eat and what they consume. And really the main protagonist, supply chain transparency and traceability, is the company, is the importer, or literally the person who will ensure that this product is manufactured, put on a boat or a plane, brought to a warehouse, and then trucked or wheeled towards to a shop. And it's in the last 30 years, obviously, with the globalization of supply chain, but also the breaking down of each part of the supply chain. The supply chain, for example, of a white cotton V-cut shirt has become incredibly complex. It will hold up to 6 different parts, sometimes for one manufacturing process, like dyeing or washing, you will have to go in 3 different locations. So it is a challenge for a company that wants to offer the transparency and traceability to consumer to actually reach it. Mm-hmm. And if I'm saying all this, is because I was that person when I was working previously in the corporate context, and when I moved into the private equity world, I was surprised to see, because this is a huge risk. I mean, it's huge risk, a financial risk. It's a risk as a regulatory risk with Modern Slavery Act and with the Due Diligence Law. It's a reputational risk, obviously, and an image risk, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very interesting to see that in private equity, the system supply chain sustainability risk is completely underestimated. So after, you know, it's been more than 3 years now that I'm working in PI, and we decided 4 months ago, actually before COVID, so in December, we decided to shed some light on that risk. And I'm happy to say that, so we organized an ESG lab for our investors, which was very interesting, because we brought the supply chain managers of our portfolio companies, NGOs, experts from the field, blockchain experts, and we got them all. We literally recreated small supply chains around different roundtables. So we had a supply chain for a hairdryer, supply chain for an orange, for a wooden toy game. And it was very interesting to see that, as often for, you know, specific ESG topics, the LPs react as consumers. They have very little knowledge, and it's fine, but they have very little knowledge of the standards, the regulations, hard law, soft law, and the industry initiatives around the topic. So we felt it was such an important topic. To me, honestly, it's the next ESG frontier. We decided after the ESG lab to write a guide, a publicly available guide, which thanks to the confinement, we spent a lot of, we were given a lot more time to write it. And I'm very happy to announce on this podcast that this guide will be published on our website next week. It's okay. A 30 plus pages guide where I've poured years of expertise. I've also interviewed colleagues from the previous previous life, from different retail companies, textile companies, garment factories, auditors, big initiatives, and I'm happy. And we wrote this guide for LPs. We have a section for LPs, a section for GPs, and a section for portfolio companies.
Okay.
And at the end, we have further readings, and we summarize all the industry standards and working groups that exist. Well, not all, obviously, that would be impossible, but we have a rather exhaustive list.
That's amazing. Yeah, as you say, I think it can be a very challenging area to understand. So that sounds like an amazing resource. And what an honor to be the platform on which to make an announcement. So I wasn't expecting that today. I actually had a question linked to that and linked to what you mentioned earlier around engagement and engaging the companies you invest in. So as you said, it's with supply chains, it must be very challenging because there are so many actors involved. Is that something that you at PAI are involved in, or you kind of limit yourself to just engaging with the firms that you've invested in, or how does that work?
So engaging with portfolio companies is a full-time job. We do consider we have three stakeholders and a kind of a cloud around us, which is the ecosystem. So, our investors are our clients, the deal teams, the investment teams are our colleagues, but they're the key to everything. Like, it's not the same if I call up a CEO and say, hey, we'd love to have an ESG roadmap, or we'd love for you to, look at the SBT approach because you're ready. It's not the same for us to do it, and for the partner in charge of the deal to call up the CEO and say, you know what, this has to be done before exit. But the third stakeholder, which is definitely what we like doing the best or most and the essence of our work, is our portfolio companies. It's typically a PAI, we have 22 portfolio companies, and it's literally 22 bodies, 22 living entities with completely different level of maturity, ambition, exposure to climate change, for instance, exposure in terms of supply chain risks. And really, it's you just can't have a one-size-fits-all approach, which,
right.
Of course, you need one, because it's better to have one than not have anything. But once you've built that one-size-fits-all approach, so, for example, we have one sustainability club a year where we bring everybody together and we get them, we do a field trip in a factory or last year was in Casino, which is the equivalent of Marks Spencer. And we had a supply chain tour of the supply chain sustainability tour of the shop, actually. We do that a lot. So we try not to be only the reporting guys,
mm-hmm.
Knocking at the door once a year to get data. So we have this sustainability clubs. We send a sustainability gazette once a month with regulatory news, so legal flash news, information about reporting about our team, about them. We try to celebrate their achievements. We have regular calls around reporting, but also advancement on the ESG roadmap. And obviously, once a year, we have a heavy ESG reporting campaign. And it's interesting, actually, because we've had this ESG reporting, we've trailblazed that part, I would say, in private equity already well before I joined PAI. But it's a continuous improvement work, because when I joined, there were a lot of indicators. We decided to cut a lot, but then we realized if you cut too much, you can't capture everything you want to capture, because ESG is huge. You want to capture employee retention, you want to capture turnover for permanent and non-permanent employees. You want to know if they won CSO awards, you want to know if they have anti-bribery corruption code of conduct, and then you're back again at 120 indicators. So it's really a moving target, where you want to be asking the relevant questions that you want to collect the information to progress. You don't want to collect the information to collect it and to look good. So we're building now a specific approach for each company. It's taking a huge amount of time. The idea is to really focus on two, three goals and to make sure that once a year you collect the data on those goals. One thing I have to say is that I do believe as a sustainability professional that reporting is a great catch-22 of our work, of our business. And you know, we've been talking about three different areas of sustainability since the beginning of this podcast, and every time I've referred to the fact that we can't measure, or it's hard to measure.
Right.
For example, biodiversity, what's the right metric? Supply chain sustainability, how many supplier audits is the right number? What's the ideal coverage rate of your supplier park? Even if you ask a number of supplier audits, how do you know they're not announced audits paid by the supplier? So you can have it's a never-ending battle to get the right data and to act and to use it in a relevant manner.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of the big challenges around ESG. Often a lot of the debate I hear is, it's such a broad spectrum of possible different indicators, as you mentioned, that you're trying to measure. There's often questions about, does it make sense to have all of these measured under the same title as ESG? Is this like, sometimes I feel like it's still a very developing and growing space. I think that ties in quite nicely with the question that I normally end my shows with, which is where I ask my guests to picture the world in 2049, so 1 year away from having to be net zero in the UK and the EU. What do you think the world will look like? You know, that might be whether in the space you work in or as a larger approach to just global society.
Well, it's a great question. I would say, instead of thinking 1 year before net zero, I would say 2049, it's millennials will be, 50, 60 years old. So hopefully they'll be CEOs by that time, managers, top managers, CEOs of their companies. What I really hope for is that they won't forget the engagement and, the youth climate strikes, the engagement, the questions they're asking right now in the recruitment interviews, and that they will live up to the worries and to the conscience they had of the great, great challenges we're facing. By that time, through regulation, through consumer action, NGO action, I'm confident we will have reached a quasi-net zero environment. I am just wondering if that we'll have done so in time. And I do believe that, who would have predicted the COVID-19 pandemic? So I do believe that by that time, we will have other battles to wage.
That's a great way to end, actually. I think for all our millennial listeners, it's a good challenge to make sure we maintain our values over time and as we hopefully get into more senior positions, and then also to keep the push on legislation and make sure that continues evolving in the direction that we hope for. So on that note, I would like to thank you very much, Cornelia, for joining us today. I think it's been a great show. Thank you.
It was great. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.